Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of April. This week, we are very pleased to have Dixie Llewellyn and Sharon Schlentner as our guests. Sharon and Dixie are instrumental in the work of our local Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society. Welcome to Nature Now, you two.
It's great to be here.
Great to be here. Wonderful time of year.
It is a wonderful time of year, and we're very happy to have you guys. But before we start speaking about native plants, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? A hint is that it's not a plant, though these creatures do include some plants in their diet.
We hope that you all had a very happy Earth Day. There were lots of great events going on to help us celebrate this wonderful place we live in. Speaking of Earth, I was listening to Cliff Mass's weekly update on the weather of KNKX this past Friday and learned that he is having a great difficulty getting his garden seeds to germinate this spring. He did some testing and found soil temperatures way lower than usual due to our much cooler air temperatures this spring, with soil temperatures usually running 10 degrees less than air temps. He advises that you hold off planting those garden seeds until about mid-May, or else start them indoors.
He has a depressing fact. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we are living through a record-breaking wet winter and spring, and the action is not over yet. The good news, we should transition to an El Nino next winter, which should be associated with a different and drier atmospheric circulation.
So it's perfect timing to have Sharon and Dixie in to visit with us this week, as it's Native Plant Appreciation Week in Washington State. And Sharon just showed me some really lovely posters that the Native Plant Society made showing camas and golden paintbrush. You should check those out. They're posted around town and they're beautiful. So what cool things have you two been seeing out there in the plant world lately?
Right across the street here at the prairie, there's beautiful camas and chocolate lilies and lomatium blooming right here in the city of Port Townsend.
I know. And the lomatium is that brilliant yellow.
So it's a bright yellow.
It's a beautiful foil to that purpley blue camas. And Jeff Gibson had posted a few weeks ago on Tweeters, which is a University of Washington site dedicated to birds, but other information gets into that site also. And he's local here in town, and he was talking about the grass widows being really prolific this year. Did you see them?
They were beautiful, yeah. They've come and gone. They're one of the earliest species blooming at the prairie. But also another beautiful species Sharon and I have both seen are the Calypso orchids.
I haven't seen one yet. They're some of my favorites.
I think Anderson Lake.
Yeah, Anderson Lake has those and some chocolate lilies and some prairie stars and beautiful blue-eyed Mary on the rock that's across the way from the water.
Cool. At my place, all of a sudden the switch has been turned on to the red elderberry and it's just blooming all over the place.
Trillium's been really late this year, but I've seen a lot more just lately. So,
and they're fawn lilies. I've seen the leaves up the Dungeness, so maybe by this week there'll be some blossoms there. Lots of cool things to see.
I hate to change the subject. There's a grim update from the marine world. Just a few days ago, we had news forwarded to us from producer Nan Evans, who has been keeping her finger on the pulse of the invasive green crab population. We had not any sign of them, and then all of a sudden in our area up to now, but last week, surveyors caught 12 green crabs at the Dungeness Wildlife Refuge north of Squim. These crabs are extremely aggressive predators, preying on native bivalves and other crustaceans. One crab can eat up to 45 clams per day, and they are very prolific breeders, worse than rabbits or rats. For more information on them, go to the Nature Now archives and look for a couple of great shows that Nan did on them a number of months ago when she went out to the green crab surveying crew with the Port Townsend Marine Science Center.
And you can go online and do a Google search for that. It really is grim news, and we'll keep you posted on what's being done about it. They're a very bad problem. But in more positive news, it's a wonderful time of the year to be out there looking for and listening for birds. With our resident birds beginning to sing and new migrants arriving daily, either to pause and feed up before continuing on their journey farther north to nest or to stay with us for the entire breeding season, it's a great time for birding. The bright warblers are among most people's favorites, with the orange-crowned warbler, Mary's Mystery Sound of last week, one of the earliest to arrive in our area, and I am hearing it everywhere out in my woods now. Mary had mentioned that she's been seeing them nearly year-round at her place, but she's among the lucky few. The vast majority of orange-crowned warblers are only here for the breeding season and generally spend the winter in the warmer climes of California or Mexico. So for such a small chapter, our Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society is very active, and it's always a great pleasure for me when I'm able to join them for a lecture, an excursion, or a work party. One thinks of most native plant groups as going on botanical forays, and while ours does plenty of this, it's also involved in some important habitat restoration work. And telling you about a couple of these projects is what we'd like to focus on this week. So some people will know that the Washington Native Plant Society has been involved with protecting and maintaining our remnant prairie that we're lucky to have right across the street from the station here, but not many know that they're also involved with restoring the beach habitat out at Point Wilson. So we should probably start our conversation talking about that project. Sharon, when did restoration work start out there?
Since the 90s, Forrest Schomer has been taking care of the invasive Scotch broom, which everybody's real familiar with. But the real work started for our restoration group in 2006 after a presentation by Charles Espy for the Olympic chapter of the Washington Native Plant Society. There had been interest before then derived from Nelsa Buckingham and others, but that's when a group of people got together and formed a plan.
Was it through aerial photos that you first got a sense of how big the problem was? What triggered people to recognize that there were some bad things going on there?
Charles's slides of the great plants and his intricate loving of all that environment really helped, but there were aerial photos that Dixie had presented to us which showed how much of the area had been degraded just by people walking from the beach to the campground and back without a specific path to go on.
You couldn't really blame people for doing that because there was no real proper signage telling people where to go. And it all looks kind of the same from the ground level. People just head to the beach. And from the aerial view, you could really see that it was just this maze of this lace network of all these trails everywhere, right?
That's right. There were over 9 just remnant trails. Our first task really was trying to decide really where trails should go and the most logical to keep open and to shut down. That was our first task of the project.
And so what defines the project area? Where exactly has the work been focused?
It's on the areas on the southeast side of the Lighthouse Road at Fort Worden, between the kitchen shelter and the lighthouse. So that whole side of the road is where we're looking at keeping that native plant habitat intact.
So the first phase was recognizing what the problem was, and then was it blocking off certain areas to traffic?
Yeah, we had kind of 3 phases of our project. The first part was just protecting the habitat from degradation and ensuring that public access had trails to the beach. And this included making sure that signs were posted on both the beach side, where you couldn't really see where to walk up, and on the roadside so that there were areas to walk. The next thing we did was to block off areas where we didn't want people to walk. We increased the restoration possibilities with that by adding jute mesh down just to stabilize the soil in those areas until the native plant communities could come back.
I've rolled out some of that mesh there, and you were describing how a lot of the plants, they've been mashed down by the traffic, but the root system is still intact. If it could just be left alone, it would come back
on
its own.
The root system on, like, the yellow sand verbena and the lomatium species, they're massive. As long as the plants were there at one time, they can grow back on their own. But we did enhance the potential on some of the other species by collecting seed and spreading it in those areas.
Uh-huh. And you collected the seed right on site there from the plants that were growing there. And was Forrest Schomer instrumental in collecting that and drying it?
Forrest Schomer was at his element.
Yeah, that's right.
Collecting seed.
He used to have Abundant Seed Foundation, right? And now has a separate company that just deals with native plant species.
Inside Passage.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
We collected the seed in July, and he took it back and dried it and cleaned it a little bit, and then we spread it in September of the same year. And it was a great amount of fun to spread that seed.
Yeah. Are invasive species a big problem in this habitat type?
Yeah, there's always invasive species.
Well, and I guess we should have an aside that one of the worst invasive species is one that was actually deliberately planted there, right? The European beech grass?
Yes, that's true. European beech grass, Ammophila arenaria, is a non-native, and it gets to be very invasive. And it originated in the North Atlantic, but it was planted deliberately on several continents as a dune stabilizer up until the 1960s. Its heavy creeping rhizome system builds up sand dunes, and it thrives on shifting sand and winds. But dunes are a dynamic entity, and they're meant to move. Ammophila creates such a heavy single monoculture, and you can see it on the western side of the road. Where it thrives, nothing else grows.
And it's really hard to get rid of, right?
It's very hard to get rid of. But on the southeast side of the road, there's just smaller patches of it. So we experimented in several ways to try and reduce its increase anyway.
So what have been the most challenging aspects of that project, and what are the most rewarding?
There's always invasives to be dealt with, but there are work parties that are main focus is in doing that. But the work parties are a challenge in some ways, but they're also the most rewarding to see how local people have kept in and helped us out with this.
Well, and it's also amazing to see how quickly things can come back. Once the trail has been blocked off, the plants, like in the next year, all of a sudden there'll be native plants back there, right?
Yes, this conservation project has been one of the most really rewarding because it takes so little effort to have these plants coming back, and it just took a little rearranging of people's habits to have them walk on trails and the other areas just come back so well.
And people don't mean to do a bad thing. They just know they want to go to the beach, and they don't realize that there are sensitive plants there that they're continuing to trample. The signage really has helped. If you go out there now, you'll see areas clearly marking where you should go to the beach.
That's right. And we hope to continue to put out little signs that tell what species are there along the side so that can help people be interested in what is growing there.
Yeah, because there are some beautiful natives that have come in there. Where are we at now with this effort?
We just finished a small grant to upgrade our barriers because we're on our third take on barriers as far as having them fall down and maintain. And so that's finished, and we'll hope to do more signage on this. The Friends of Fort Worden have really helped us in this effort, and we're still watching and hopefully put more informational things out.
Now we should move on to talking about the Kaitai Prairie Project, and we'll direct most of these questions towards Dixie, since she's been involved with protecting this beautiful area for many years. So how many years have you been caring for the prairie, Dixie?
I've been involved with the prairie since the mid-1990s, although others have been involved since the mid-80s.
Would you please give us a brief review of the history of the prairie?
Okay. Well, let's start 10,000 years ago, and it's basically a relic from a glacial retreat, and it used to cover the entire valley, but it luckily was saved by benign neglect. It's within the golf course, and they basically didn't need any more fairways or greens and just left this one area alone. And so it was recognized as being a prairie of having special plants. Actually, there's 27 prairie indicator species in 1995 by Jerry Bergstrom. Cool.
How large an area is protected now?
It's about 1.5 acres, and it's all owned by the city of Port Townsend. They own the city golf course, and it was negotiated back in the early 90s and late 95 that they would basically preserve this. We have a lease. We would preserve this area into perpetuity so it wouldn't get plowed under.
Oh, good. But part of it did get torn up in the late 1980s when the city dug a utility ditch through the middle of it, right?
A 2-foot by 8-foot wide ditch was dug through the middle of the prairie to put in some utilities. But since then, we've done some restoration on this spot, and we brought in native soils of the valley, Happy Valley area. It's basically the same soil type, which is Townsend gravelly sandy loam.
Uh-huh.
So it should match the dark black soils that are in the prairie. And we've been planting, school groups have planted the ditch, and we've been planting the ditch. And you can still see where the ditch was, but it's recovering.
The Point Wilson Project has involved a lot of restoration work, and other than the ditch restoration, the prairie has been more a matter of maintaining habitat that was already there, right? But maintaining it requires burning for a prairie, for a grassland environment. So how do you get around that?
It's a special type of maintenance. You don't usually think of maintaining as burning. But we burned the prairie in the year 2000 with just a few of us with the Nature Conservancy. And then once again, we burned the prairie in 2008 with the fire department and hoses, and it was a larger area. Both burns resulted in enormous, beautiful blooms the following spring.
Yeah,
so there was a lot of carbon recycling
that
happened within that process.
So in addition to burning every year, you also mow every fall to keep the brush down, right?
We do. We try to actually even mow the native shrubs because we're trying to get the herbaceous prairie species to encourage them.
So is there much of a problem with invasive species in the prairie?
Minor. We've gotten most of the Scots broom out, but it's the grass, some of the rhizomatous non-native grasses. They're prevalent everywhere.
The orchard grass edges out the native fescue?
The great native fescue is what we're trying to encourage.
Yeah, but the orchard grass is the non-native invasive species.
There's also a hair grass in there as well.
Uh-huh. What's the best time of the year to see it?
Now, this year. Last year, it was about 2 weeks earlier because of the cold spring.
And how sensitive is it? Do people need to be careful when they go view it?
The best advice is tread lightly and just enjoy the prairie. They're often nesting killdeer and or yellow jacket nests, so tread lightly.
Oh, there's lots of exciting stuff going on. So thanks so much for joining us and for all of your hard work restoring these areas. Now we're going to go on and tell you about upcoming natural history events, but there was so much going on last week for Earth Day that there's not too much going on. But Sharon, what do you have for us?
The Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter does have a field trip planned for this Sunday, April 30th. Meet at the Cary Blake Park up in Squim at 10 a.m. to go look for early spring birds. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for details.
And here's our mystery sound again.
It is a surf scoter, or rather, the wing whistle of many surf scoters as they wing their way across the sea. These birds are generally silent, but the wings make a great humming noise in flight, especially if they are in a large group.
The surf scoters are large, mostly black or dark gray sea ducks. The male has a solid black body and black head with white patches on the back of the head and on the forehead above the eyes. The distinctive pattern has earned this bird the nickname Skunk Head Coot. It also has a remarkable orange, yellow, and white bill, which makes it look rather clown-like. The female is much more dull in coloration, brownish-gray, with pale patches near the bill base. I chose it for the mystery sound because of reading about an extraordinary observation that David Armstrong wrote in to the UW Tweeter site about last week. Our family went on a gray whale trip out of Langley, Whidbey Island, on Saturday. At one point, the vessel was 100 to 200 meters off Baby Island at the mouth of Holmes Harbor. We finally realized that a thick black line a short ways off was the largest raft of surf scoters we'd ever seen, easily 900 to 1,000 plus birds.
Wow, I've seen flotillas of surf scoters before, but never anything approaching that size. They are one of three species of scoter in our area and are common winter residents here. Soon they'll be headed off to breed in the far north, from West Alaska to Labrador.
And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the third week of April. Thanks so much for joining me, Sharon and Dixie. And where should people go to volunteer for work parties or to hear about what's going on? Is it the WNPS website?
It is. Yes. It's WNPS.org. And then go local chapters and go to the Olympic Peninsula.
And there's chapter. Some beautiful photos in there, and you can link to the newsletters. Yeah, there's lots going on.
Look at all of our events.
Well, there's a lot going on. You guys do a great job organizing it. So thanks very much to all the rest of you for listening. And remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Robin Spielberg playing Prairie.